Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Nikki Smith, whose daughter has been in and out of eating disorder treatment for 12 years. Together, we discuss Nikki's journey with different eating disorder treatment approaches and hold on to hope that recovery is possible for all.
It's so lovely, Nikki, to finally be chatting to you. It feels like literally forever since we first had our conversation. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It's an absolute pleasure to join you, and I look forward to chatting with you for the next however long it takes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess what would be really nice if we start with who you are. Maybe do you want to tell us a bit about yourself first? Because I always say, tell us who you are and your experience. But no, let's learn who Nikki is first.
Let's start right at the beginning. Right, so I am a mum of three children, two boys and a girl, and obviously a wife. And also in my career, I am a lecturer at university. So I wear lots of hats on a different daily basis. But today I'm really talking to you, or sort of just having a chat regarding anorexia, because my daughter has been anorexic now for nearly 12 years. Diagnosed at 14 and currently 25, about to be 26. And we've just, as a family, had a really challenging 12 years. It's affected, obviously, my daughter massively, but from family dynamics as well. And it's just tough. It's really tough for a family to go through. And unless you are, I don't say the word lucky enough, but to meet other people in the same position and draw comfort and be able to sort of speak to each other about what's going on, it's impossible for normal friends and colleagues to know what's going on in an everyday life, because why should they? It's a horrible, horrible illness, and it's a very long-standing. So I guess a little bit of history of our anorexic journey. We've had lots of experience from adolescent services, adolescent community, adolescent inpatient, and then sort of total discharge, and then a few months later into adult services, adult eating disorder services, starting off in community, and then getting into adult inpatient services. In between times, my daughter tried to get to university. In fact, did get to university, managed to do really well in her A-levels. So we moved to a university town, for better or worse. In hindsight, I don't think we should have let her go, but she really wanted to go. So went to a university town, and within 3 months was sectioned under the Mental Health Act and taken into an eating disorder unit in the university city. Basically spent 3 years in the university city inpatient unit, being discharged maybe for a month or two, relapsing dramatically, and then having to go back in. So that was 3 years. She was then discharged on a therapeutic break from that particular eating disorder service, and back home to our home, where she lasted about another 6 weeks and then was resectioned again, but this time into an acute mental health unit, which was absolutely awful. Totally the wrong place. We had nurses and doctors telling us, even passing me notes saying, she shouldn't be here, you need to get her into eating disorder services. That took 6 weeks to actually get an eating disorder consultant to come and meet her again. And then within 24 hours, she was back in an eating disorder unit, where she stayed for 2 years, literally 2 years. We then had funding to move to a step-down unit, which was great in theory, sounded really good. It was a small home, six-bedded, 24/7 support for eating disorders. Fortunately, that didn't work either, so she was resectioned back into the current eating disorder unit, where she remains at the moment. So she's had a long, long journey. We've had a long journey as a family. Her brothers have, you know, understand it, particularly her younger brother, because he can't remember life without eating disorders in the family. And that's our story, really. We've had experiences, as I say, of being sectioned under the Mental Health Act. We've had lots of experience of NG feeding under restraint. So really the nasty things that that just happen, and it's sad and it's hard. So that's a little bit of my story in brief, if that's such a word, brief.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it sounds very much like your daughter's been thrown about a bit into lots of different services. And I wonder, maybe, I don't know whether you've reflected on this before, but the sort of movement from one service to the next, you know, the discharge, the going back in sort of thing, what impact that has had on her and on yourself as well, for kind of trialing so many different things, but never really finding the thing that works.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, actually. We still haven't really found the thing that works. I'm acutely aware that this illness is a very individual illness, and you know, what works for somebody doesn't work for another person. I think we are still trying to look, the team is still trying to look for something that really does work. Sadly, at the moment, my daughter feels that there is nothing out there that can help her. She's so entrenched. She just doesn't believe in herself or the fact that anyone in services anywhere in the country can help. So that's a big challenge. In terms of, she struggles dramatically with discharge, you know, leaving change altogether, which is a very common trait, I think, in anorexia. But I think on almost each inpatient stay, it's got to a stage where she was having no quality of life, not gaining anything by being inpatient any longer. I think the problem is, and I've always said this, is discharge at quite a relatively low weight still, quite a low BMI, but mentally really not in the right place. And to be discharged from 24/7 support to 1-2 hours, if you're lucky, in most services, I know there are some community services that offer more, but if someone's not in the right mindset to voluntarily take more support, that's a challenge in itself. But usually 1-2 hours a week, it's just, I mean, you know, if you look at the relapse figures and the number of people that are back in units, there isn't one unit I think that my daughter's ever been in where she's not come across people that have been in the same unit months, years before. It is, and my daughter is a classic revolving door patient. And I think that's the sadness of it. I think whilst inpatient, everywhere we've been, they are lovely, lovely people. I take my hat off to nurses, healthcare support workers. They couldn't be kinder and nicer. But I think they're challenged. I think resources are low, short staffing, et cetera, et cetera. And there's, you know, one inpatient unit that she was in, there was no psychologist at all. For a whole year, so we had to pay for someone to come in. It was when COVID was going on as well, so we paid for online. It cost us a lot of money, and it wasn't really helpful. But to be inpatient with no psychologist in post, and when eventually the psychologist was in post, my daughter was on a discharge. You know, she was being transferred to an outpatient unit, but that's a long time to go without any therapy.
Particularly when you're in an inpatient setting, and you know, you don't get to an inpatient setting because things are going okay. You go to an inpatient setting because you need that intervention and you need that quick. So to not have, you know, the intervention you really need offered.
And I think that's really important. I also think that the sadness again of the way it is at the moment is that people have to become so ill. So such a low BMI to get into an inpatient unit, which is wrong. But I, you know, I fully appreciate that just the beds aren't there, the support's not there. But it's just such a shame that you are literally so low BMI. So there's massive build up before you can even start doing any therapeutic work, which is a challenge. So that takes a long time. I think the worst thing, well, there's been many worse things, but one of the big challenges we had was when my daughter was taken to a general hospital, and then we really came across the difference between eating disorder specialist care and a general hospital, which couldn't have been more the wrong place. Well, I don't know which was worse, actually, an acute mental health unit or a general hospital. Both of them have left dramatic, sort of traumatic times in my daughter's mind. Really not recommended. And again, not the fault of the individual people. They're doing their best. The gastro wards where she ended up just had never had an eating disorder patient before with such severity. And it caused a lot of concern for the nurses because they would say things like, well, we're used to making people better. We can't make you better. And then being NG restrained by hospital security guards. So we all hear of it. But when it's happening to you, I mean, she's not the only one that that's ever happened to. We all in this world know that it happens, but it's not right that hospital security guards, untrained, should be lying on top of a very frail person. But again,
I can imagine that the trauma from that is then, you know, building on whatever sort of mental health complications somebody has already. And, you know, I think there is a time and a place for inpatient treatment, of course, but my personal perspective is it should be, you know, it really shouldn't be given unless someone is absolutely needing it and that the service provided is going to be completely appropriate for them. Because I've heard so many times of people, you know, often they will have the inpatient treatment, be discharged, and it will really help. And that was the kickstart for them.
Yeah.
But there are so many people who they do end up just going back again because one, they've been discharged at a point where they're literally not ready. And two, they've built so many more issues by being in hospital, whether it's competitive nature or things that have gone on. And actually, it's just made their situation worse.
Yeah. And I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head. There are the two categories. I was supporting a parent the other day and her daughter is 26, 27. Recognised that she was absolutely going downhill. I hadn't really been involved with eating disorder services a lot, but she self put herself into one of the Priory eating disorder units in Scotland and did a short course. And she wanted to go. She was adult enough and she wasn't entrenched enough to realise that's what she needed to do. And that's absolutely, as far as we know, halted it. She's managed to engage with the treatment. She got the therapy. And it worked. So if you can catch an eating disorder early enough, young enough, I think the evidence is there to prove that there is a system and it does work. I guess I'm coming from the 11, 12 years, sort of a bit long in the tooth there all, and it's not working yet and it hasn't quite got there through no one's fault. It seems a bit of a lack of inflexibility for discussion between clinicians and moving from one place to another because there's no beds or no funding. It seems to be that wherever you live, that is the eating disorder unit you go to if there's a bed. And then, you know, I don't know, we are trying at the moment to explore everywhere in the UK for particularly where my daughter might be more appropriately. But then the chances of her getting in anywhere else with a different team that's offering something slightly different is very minimal, and you know it's a gamble whether it'd work or not, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do you think that they change that? Because it does feel like it is very much a gamble as to whether you're going to get the right sort of care based on where you are, but also I hate this idea as well that if the person that's getting the treatment is in the right frame of mind, it's going to work. And if they're not in the right frame of mind, it's not going to work. Because at the end of the day, they have a mental health condition. And it's not like you can just switch your mind and be like, okay, today I want to recover because now I'm in hospital, I'm going to recover. Yeah. But that's kind of what they're asking people to do. And a lot of the time you have to get to that point to be, you know, I personally have never been in an inpatient unit, but it's taken me years to be at the point where I'm like, okay, actually, I'm going to start doing this. And every single day I'm like, do I actually want to? But something inside of me is pushing that forwards. But I equally know that's because I'm now at a weight where I can sustain that and my brain is like, actually, yeah, we will recover.
Yeah. And I think what you've just said there hits the nail on the head. We are, everyone is constantly told waiting for that magic moment, waiting for the light bulb moment where somebody wants to. And I think the problem is when you've been so entrenched for so long and nothing has really worked, then the want and the belief, it just isn't there. I think it must be something that clinicians and healthcare professionals hear all the time when you're an inpatient, you know, I can't do it. But equally, in my daughter's case, I feel she's not necessarily pushed. It's very much patient led. She will probably be very cross with me saying that. And I'm not sure that's my interpretation. There could be many, many reasons as to why it has to be a joint sort of agreement, but her meal plan hasn't changed now for well over a year, and it's very basic and nowhere near enough. And yes, we all know that, you know, the brain is starved, and until you get to a cognitive, I hate using the word BMI in comparison, but until you get to a BMI where your brain can start to work, then your thoughts just aren't going to be there. And I think that's the crux of it, isn't it? That's the hardest thing, is to get to that level. And how you get a patient to get to that particular stage where the brain is starting to have a little bit of feed and feeling better, when someone actively doesn't want to do that, is a real challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that's so hard for everyone. That's hard.
And I think that's what's the hardest part about eating disorder recovery, is that at the end of the day, in order to recover, you have to do the thing that you want to do the least.
Yeah.
You know, whether that is eat, whether that is gain weight, whether that's stop exercising, you know, you've got to do that in order to recover. And, you know, when you were saying that earlier about your daughter being on a general patient unit, I was quite interested to talk to you about how the medical staff worked with that, because I did my master's dissertation on paediatric nurses providing support to people with eating disorders in a general paediatric ward. And a lot of the kind of things that came up was, well, we don't have training on eating disorders, so how can we know how to support somebody, which I totally get. But then equally, you know, if you've got somebody on a ward and they don't eat their dinner, you know, random Joe blogs on the street, if they miss a couple of meals whilst they're in hospital, it's not really an issue. But if somebody's in because they've got chronically severe anorexia, you need to be making sure that they're eating all their meals, they're not exercising, all of those different things. So I just wondered what your experience had been there, because I mean, you said it wasn't great.
It's not been great. Thankfully, we haven't had many general hospital admissions. We had, when my daughter's in the adolescent services, we went to a children's ward, and they absolutely had no idea on how to treat anyone with anorexia. And I remember we were in a ward of about nine people, and my daughter was right at the far end. And basically, they just left her, because the very first day, I think, this is bearing in mind someone who just hadn't eaten was literally eating, I don't know, fruit and nothing else, and had done for months. And I just remember her very first meal time, they put a meal card on the desk, and it's like Jackie potato and baked beans and a cheese sandwich and, you know, all the things that were absolute massive fear foods. And I remember one nurse with her folded hands at the end of the bed just tapping her feet and saying, come on, don't be such a silly little girl, just eat. And admittedly, she was 15 at the time, but that was our first introduction. And the dietitian, because I think she was there for medical stability rather than mental health treatment, the dietitian didn't really get involved. Three or four days, well, she was only there for 3 or 4 days, so that wasn't great. But the worst one was a year ago, actually, when she went to a general hospital. And the nurses, as you say, even down to the head nurse, the head nutritional nurse, she was called, actually, had never heard of mead, was just totally unaware of eating disorders, particularly. And she was very good. She wanted to find out more, so I gave her details of mead and how to look into things. But, you know, we've had arguments about NG feeding, where my daughter's a vegetarian, so she refused to have the normal NG feed. So some hospitals would make exceptions and go to different units or go to different places to get vegetarian NG feeding, I suppose. Others flatly refused. Nurses found it really hard because, as you've said, most of them, they were general nurses in a general ward. We had, I think one of them said, I literally had a 1 hour lecture on eating disorders in the whole 3 years. Never done my placement on an eating disorder unit or even on a gastro ward. Just no idea what we're doing. So, you know, she was on one-to-one watch, but the one-to-one watch didn't include, you know, she was allowed to shut the shower door. She was allowed to shut the toilet door. So therefore, you can imagine from a severely ill anorexic patients what went on, because they didn't know better. And, you know, she found it very tough. And I think the worst thing, as I say, was the twice a day NG feeding. It was distressing, not just for the nurses, but for the other patients in the ward. You could hear everything from outside. And also, you know, for the security guys themselves, I mean, I don't think they particularly liked it. It was unnatural for them. But the bruising and the dislocated jaw that happened once wasn't great.
So, what was that from?
Just wrongly supporting or wrongly restraining her as they're trying to feed her. She's had a tough time. She has had a tough time. And it just goes on. But as I am very quick to point out, you know, everyone who is with her at the moment are doing their best.
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? When you were saying about, you know, the nurses and things, having one lecture, it's just not fair to expect people that are general medical professionals to be treating somebody with such a severe and unique difficulty, because even, you know, even people that train in eating disorders for years, they still will meet a client or patient and there'll be a completely different presentation to what they're used to.
Absolutely.
So it's not fair to have the expectation that they can just be treated, you know, on the same piece of paper. It's so not fair on you and your family to have people that are you know, they are not trained.
No.
Or they're not, they shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, to end up with bruises and things like that, I mean, that in itself, I'm not being funny, but that's enough to make you think, I don't want to recover from this, because if I have to go through this, which you do not have to go through things like that in order to recover. But if you've got that mentality of this is what recovery looks like for me, I don't think anybody would want to go through that.
It's very true. I think, I teach, I guess, lecture, even though it's nothing to do with my particular faculty. We do have nursing courses. So I've got myself involved with the nursing course and I go and do some guest lecturing on raising awareness for eating disorders. And I sort of, you know, teach first year students and they're about to go off on placement. And I just think how scary to go on. I mean, most of them don't go onto an eating disorder unit from the university that I'm working at. They go onto general hospitals. But it's a very scary side of nursing, and I think they're amazing. Anyone that can work, anyone that's a nurse, but anyone that can work in an eating disorder, because, as you say, you have got. My daughter can be incredibly vocal and can be incredibly bad tempered and say some horrible, horrible things, which just isn't her. But in that moment of flight and whatever they call it, she's hard. And, you know, the nurses are always non-judgmental. They don't hold grudges. And she knows when she comes down from whatever the incident's been, she's back to being how she is. But I think that's the nature of the illness. It's so up and down and so hard for anyone to nurse. And I think not this unit, but another unit that she was in, one of the outbursts really put this student nurse off coming back the next day. And it's hard. You've got to be very, very resilient, I'm sure, but it should be covered more. So unless a nurse has a placement that happens to be on a SEDU, you know, and that's even more apparent when you end up in A&E. I mean, that's another story in itself, isn't it? A&E. I think A&E, the emergency department, as it's now called, we've been many, many times over the years in the emergency department, and 9 times out of 10, no knowledge whatsoever. We sit there for 4 or 5 hours, and then it's a case of we don't quite know what to do with you. And obviously, my daughter was saying, "Well, send me home. I'm not doing anything else." And we come home, and it starts all over again. I think in recent years there seems to be some sort of mental health nurse that's always in an emergency department, which makes it slightly better, but not ideal. And again, many emergency departments, when they've never heard of MEAD, and that continues. So you sort of try and present your motherly thing and have you read MEAD? Will you go by those guidelines? And they're obviously too busy to look at MEAD at that moment in time. So there's a lot of still raising awareness to do. I think there's some great clinicians out there and some people that are ready to, you know, open to sort of trying to get the word out and trying to get things out there. But I guess it's a huge task.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's difficult because, like you said, you know, that you can have the lectures and the kind of raising the awareness, but actually, you know, from your experience, and you know, I've been the same. When you put a plate of food in front of me, I'm an absolute bitch because yeah. I don't want to eat. It's the last thing I want to do, and I probably will be horrible to you, but I'm not actually a horrible person. It's the eating disorder coming out. And I think, you know, you can read all of the textbooks you want to, but then actually being able to have the resilience, like you say, to work with somebody, to want to come back to help them. And I've mentioned it before on the podcast as well, you know, particularly when someone's an inpatient, you get to see them literally at their worst. You get to see them when, you know, they're at the depth of despair. They don't know what to do. Like they're not in a place where they really want to recover. But you don't get to see them, you know, years or whatever after when they are then recovered and they're thriving. So you really, that resilience and that support that is needed for those medical professionals is astronomical, and they don't get any of that.
No, it is, and that's sad, isn't it? On the current ward, I remember not so long ago someone saying to me, oh, we had a letter from, and she's now teaching, or she's now a nursery nurse or something. So I think that's really, you know, that boosts them. But on an everyday basis, it must be hard. And I guess it's with age and experience and knowledge that nurses get the confidence to realise it's that person isn't a nasty person, it is the illness. And many times, you know, we're told, you know, we know it's the illness, we know that you're not a nasty person, but it's hard for them.
I wanted to ask about a bit more about the NG tube feeding, because we haven't really spoken about that much on the podcast, but what's the kind of, I guess if we're talking about the logistics of it, is that something that's enforced on somebody, or do they have the choice, or how do they go about that when they want to make that decision?
Okay. As far as my understanding is, and in our case, my daughter's sectioned under the Mental Health Act, so therefore she has no choice. If it's deemed necessary and essential, and I guess almost life-saving, nobody does NG feeding lightheartedly. Because it's not nice in the slightest way. And I think also, you know, I think at one stage when my daughter was NG fed, it was a case of we're doing this because you just need a break of having to think, I've got to have another mealtime, I've got to get through another mealtime, and you're so exhausted by it. We need to give you, you know, a few days for your however long it takes break. I'm not sure how it works with someone who isn't actually sectioned. So that would be someone who voluntarily puts himself into an eating disorder unit. I guess if they voluntarily put themselves in, and that is something that's deemed absolutely necessary. I remember the first time her university town and NG feeding was the very first time that she was fed. And I think she wasn't particularly... well, none of us had any knowledge of it, so it was quite accepted. And again, that's a strange thing, because different SEDUs do it different ways. So one eating disorder unit, there was a continual drip feed all the time. She was attached to, you know, one of those hooky things, and there was continually dripping feed. Whereas the current placement does it literally... well, did do it, she's off the NG tube at the moment, just twice a day. They call it a bolus feed. So, and then in the hospital, certainly, they just came in and, just had this great syringe and did it. But each time, again, each time it depends. It depends on the patient, because sometimes they will accept it, other times they will just pull out. So there's a thing they call a bridge, where it's sort of they insert something so it's impossible to pull out. So that depends, I guess, on how adamant the patient is, doesn't want to be NG fed. So it's not nice. But again, it's never done lightheartedly, I think it is. I think in adolescent services... in fact, the eating disorder unit where our daughter was in an adolescent services, they didn't do NG feeding. She went into a general hospital to be NG fed and then came back to the unit afterwards. Because I think different units do it different ways.
And you mentioned before sort of, you know, the impact that had on people around as well. I mean, if you don't want to talk about it, you have to, but just kind of was interested as to what you meant by that in terms of the impact it was having on other people.
So I think it's not nice when there are people on the ward that are being NG fed. It can be said that the other patients find it triggering because it becomes one of those competitive things. Oh, well, so-and-so is being NG fed, therefore my anorexia is telling me I need to get worse and lose weight because I need to be NG fed too. So there's that illogical thought, but it's there. Certainly, I know when my daughter's been NG fed, she's very, very vocal and there's lots of screaming and shouting. So that's not nice for other patients to hear. And she's dragged from one room to the other, but, you know, and it's not nice for the nurses because, you know, they don't want to NG feed someone who's so adamantly against it and so squirming and kicking out, you know, strong, considering how frail a person can be. The strength that suddenly comes out is hard. So it does, at the moment in time, have a big impact on people, both patients and staff. It's not nice.
And it is sad because it's sad that the reality is that it is life and death, and still the people that are going through the anorexia, yeah. That, you know, they still don't want that, which I think just kind of is such a sad reality of how much anorexia does take over your brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And punish your brain.
Yeah, yeah. It's a horrible illness, horrible, illogical illness.
Yeah.
And I think that's half the problem. It's totally illogical. You can't explain it. People can't understand it because it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And I think that was something that I wanted to come on with, to talk about with you was, you know, it is illogical completely, but when you're in the depths of it, it feels like the most logical thing in the whole entire world. And you almost sit there thinking, well, I can't understand why you don't get this. Mm-hmm. And I can't understand why you're asking me to do something that, you know, is so terrifying.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you about sort of, you mentioned at the start, you know, other parents or friends and stuff like that couldn't comprehend or couldn't understand how you navigated that. Because I know for my mum, when I was first diagnosed, that was something that was so difficult for her. She didn't want to speak to anybody, any of her friends, because she felt like she had let me down.
Yeah. And that's a hard one, isn't it? It's, I think, oh, I'm going back, what, right at the beginning now. I was devastated when 12 years ago this all happened because I didn't understand it. You know, we were just a normal, happy family with Sunday lunch and sport at the weekends, and my daughter played netball and the boys played rugby. And we were just a normal family, if there's such a thing. But, you know, there was nothing that sort of led to this. I've got, as I say, two boys either side. Heavily into rugby, football, swimming, my daughter herself, county netball. It just, and then suddenly it hit us literally within a month or two. We got this diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And people often say, well, what made you take her to the doctor? And I generally can't remember. But I just, the first introduction I got was when the doctor, actually the GP, picked it up and said, well, let's just weigh you. And I just remember her peeling off, you know, layer after layer of school uniform and, you know, three pairs of tights, which I hadn't picked up on. And, I mean, from that moment on, our lives changed. And I think friends were sympathetic, but even today people say, well, why isn't she doing it? Or has Madam decided she's not going to? Or they just don't get it. And I'm constantly using the cancer scenario. You know, if you've got cancer or a broken leg, you can't just snap out of it. So why are you asking someone with a mental illness and thinking, but it doesn't work. We've got friends that now avoid me in the supermarket queues just because they don't know what to say. And I don't hold back now. When someone asks how she is, I don't sort of lie and go, oh, fine, because she's not fine. And not fine. And I don't go into any great depth, but I know people just don't want to hear it. I think it, from my perspective, I joined up with Feast and met some really super, and there's only a small group of us in the UK, but they've all been through it. And I think if you can find someone that you can click and just, you know, we have a WhatsApp group, we meet up, we have fun, we have chats about all sorts of things, not just eating disorders. But everybody knows when someone's having a bad day and they know what to say. And, you know, couple of the members are really super with my daughter. They speak to her as much. In fact, I keep saying, you've taken my friend away, you are. But, you know, because they've been there, they've done it, they know what to say, they know how to react, they know not to make triggering comments. And, you know, most of the comments that friends and family make, you know, I've been told, well, why don't you just put her on a plane and go and sit on a beach, or, you know, just silly things.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
But are meant with the best intention, absolutely best intention in the world. And you just have no reply to that, do you? You know, so with friends, we don't really talk about it. I mean, they will ask out of politeness, some will. And others just do not get it even all these years later. But then others are supportive. So it's a real... and as for my two sons, my eldest son, he was at university when my daughter was first diagnosed. So he's never really lived amongst it and doesn't really get it, doesn't really like talking about it, does his best, but really doesn't get it. And then my younger son, he's very good. He's been, as I say, for the last 14 years, he's absolutely lived and sounds awful, but, you know, I think he thinks he's taken second best because obviously, so we're constantly trying to say he's not taken second best. But, you know, we sometimes have to go and see my daughter when there's other things, you know, when we should be supporting him in a football match and you can't tear yourselves in two. Mm-hmm. But we get there, you know, it's just a way of life for us now. It's a big impact, really, on close family and even, you know, extended family. Super, but not everybody gets it, and why should they, you know, unless you've lived it, unless you've got it. It's not like cancer, it's not sort of or any other ailment, physical ailment, where you read about it, you hear about it, you know what's out there. It's a very sort of, I hate to say niche market, because it's not a niche market at all, but it's a niche area, and everyone's heard of it as a disorder, but they don't really.
I think the difficulty is as well is that with cancer, you know, if somebody's diagnosed with cancer, we all seem to understand that, you know, yes, you can do things yourself that will make you feel, you know, mentally better, and you know you can give yourself a healthier lifestyle, and maybe your chances of remission will be better then. But ultimately, you know, we would never say to somebody that passes away or that's, you know, that has cancer, oh well, it's because they didn't try hard enough in their treatment. You would literally never say that. However, you know, you massively say, oh, the chemo didn't work or something like that. But with anorexia or eating disorders in general, it's always, oh, you know, the individual wasn't in the right frame of mind. Or even if people don't understand it, they see it that the individual themselves doesn't want to recover, or they're not engaging in treatment and things like that. And then that's when, you know, the difficult conversations then arise. And I think that's what makes it so hard to comprehend, because you'll say to people so many times, you know, I'm doing recovery and I'm trying, and you know, I've just not found the thing that works for me. But because your experience is so unique and the treatment that you'll also need is so unique, it is a minefield. And, you know, I don't even understand it myself. You know, I'm on my recovery journey now. Why? Why did one day I think, you know, I'm going to start doing it now, rather than, you know, before when I was like, I literally never want to. I have no desire to do it at all. It's, you know, if I can't explain that to you, then nobody's going to be able to understand it.
And I think also when it comes to, you know, a cancer diagnosis or a heart diagnosis or whatever, there's a very, very clear pathway from the word go. You don't have to wait to get so much worse before you actually get into services. You don't sort of get offered, well, yes, we know we might see you once a week whilst we're waiting to get you into services. It's a very clear structured path. It's very easy to speak to healthcare professionals, and they never give up. You know, you can have cancer, you can have stage 4 cancer, but the health service never gives up on you. It keeps trying and trying and trying until the very last, when it's perfectly obvious. Whereas with eating disorders, I'm sure you've heard now this sort of particular group of cohort that are pushing for the palliative care route, which, you know, you can't give up on something that's completely treatable or recovery is absolutely possible. But just because it doesn't happen in the first 5 weeks, 5 months, 5 years, 15 years, whatever, ultimately someone can recover or at least learn to live a fulfilled life and cope with And because that is, as you said, it's just such an individual thing and very hard to explain when that moment's suddenly going to happen, it's a case of supporting and working with these people to help find that particular, I say, light bulb moment, whatever moment it is. So that's very, very different to a physical illness where, as I say, it's structured, you know, appointments, you know who you're seeing, you can speak, et cetera, et cetera.
I also think with a physical illness, it's very much like you kind of just said it there, like it's very much more obvious when the end date is. Like, you know, if there's no chance of recovery for somebody with cancer, then there's no chance of recovery. Whereas with an eating disorder, in my eyes anyway, there is always, like, everybody has the ability to recover. It's just they need to be given the right resources and the right support, it be in the right environment, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, if somebody's got cancer and their body is shutting down, that's very different to somebody that has been struggling with anorexia and not found the right treatment for them. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess if people are listening and think, well, you know, if somebody's at their wit's end with their eating disorder, they don't want to be here anymore. You know, they've tried recovery for years. Let's offer them palliative care. And we're both sat here saying that's a friggin' stupid idea. Why is that a stupid idea? Because to Joe Blogs on the Street, they might think, well, that sounds like the best option because the treatment's not working for them.
I think that's really hard. And, you know, it can be, there can be times when a patient's within treatment where they are begging for palliative care and they're absolutely exhausted. As I say, have no belief that anything can be found. They've tried every type of therapy, every type of inpatient, outpatient community. Nothing is making them feel any better or move on to where they need to be. So that must be quite hard for a consultant to hear. I just want to die. I just want to die. I can't do this anymore. I'm exhausted. And I'm thinking there must, because that's what the anorexic brain is saying, isn't it? That's what, and you can see why someone is absolutely drained and exhausted of anorexic thoughts going on day in, day out, you know, nighttime, daytime, all the time. So, you know, it's an option that it must be hard for, as I say, for a healthcare professional team to listen to that and then ultimately not say, well, actually, that's your wish. And I think that's half the problem, isn't it? Because if that is someone's wish, do they have the mental capacity to make that, or is that the anorexic brain that's saying that? And then that's when it becomes so difficult in ethics and everything else, isn't it? Mm. So it's a very dodgy path. I can't see it, but I can see how things can be interpreted, and it's just, yeah, it's wrong. Because, but then making someone that's so ill live such a horrible life for so long, you know, but then you know there is recovery, you know, and ever, there's so many people out there that who, you know, have been given the right pathway, have managed to get the right type of support in the right sort of unit, which might be slightly different, or has been involved in current research that sort of has managed to break the cycle, that have recovered, gone on to have families and children. So it's a very big area.
It's hard as well, because I think, you know, when somebody is in the depths of anorexia, I don't think that they have a mind that is supportive to their longevity. You know, at the end of the day, anorexia is there to do one thing only, and that's to destroy your life in whatever format that looks like. So to ask somebody in that state that has, you know, not really got enough energy to walk up the stairs or to do anything for themselves, let alone make a conscious decision, you know, as I've said before, I've never been in an inpatient setting. If you'd have asked me when I was at my sickest, do you still want to be here? The answer probably would have been no. But, you know, that was because the anorexia, the eating disorder, my mental health was at the worst it's ever been. So those thoughts did creep in. And I think we spoke about this when we had our initial chat, in that if you sat down with a patient with severe depression and suicidal ideation and said to them, you know, you have the option of palliative care, do you want it? that would never be offered. No. Like, let's be real, because they're struggling with depression and suicidal ideation. So why is it any different in an eating disorder when, you know, with somebody with depression would be offered lifelong support until, you know, even if that depression never kind of goes away from them, they'll be offered that support. So I really struggle to comprehend why the difference is there, because yes, somebody may say, I don't want to be here, I want to die. But equally, for other mental health conditions, we still wouldn't be doing that.
No, we wouldn't. And I think the problem is, you 9 times out of 10, you have the eating disorder and you have the suicidal ideas, and then you also mm-hmm. have the depression as well. It's all terribly intertwined. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe there is medication that can help depression and things. I think the problem with, because someone is so late, whatever medications, they don't really get chance to work properly because they've got nothing to work with, which is another problem as well. I think, but you're right. It's just something that should never, well, obviously I'm going to say that from a parent's perspective, but it's palliative care just should not be considered. It's just not right on any form or any way. It's almost like bringing sort of Switzerland into England, isn't it? There's virtually no other condition where people where treatment would cease.
But I was under the impression that when you go, when you're like restrained under the Mental Health Act, that's because you don't have capacity. So how can you then make a decision for palliative care if you don't have capacity?
Yeah, I don't know. We're not at that stage, thankfully. And that I have said that sort of vocally, I exactly that question. I do not understand when someone is sectioned under the Mental Health Act, which means that you don't have capacity for your own safety. You don't have control of your emotions and you can't see what you need to do. You're sectioned. And then on the other hand, it is the palliative care thing comes in and the patient has a voice. I don't understand it. I don't. There must be, I don't know, it's a loophole, or there must be something, and I'm sure a clinician would be able to answer that. But to me, it's a sort of like a double-edged sword. It's sort of, well, you section, so therefore everything's taken. You know, they can section you and feed you again and G-feed you against your will. Then I don't understand it. I can't answer that one.
No. God. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was just thinking when you were talking about it. I was like, this doesn't really add up. It's almost as though the clinician is then making the choice that that's the best option for you, that the best option is palliative care. And so it's almost giving up, you know, if we're going to be frank about it and be blunt, then, and I just don't see that that is a way that, that things should be going.
No, I don't think it's the way it should be going. I honestly don't know enough about it from a parent's perspective. I don't think there's that many cases. There should be no cases that go down the palliative care route at all. But I guess from the clinician's point of view, if they've, and this sounds really brutal, but if they've tried everything for so long, nothing is working, they have a patient that is begging to be put on the palliative care route, et cetera, and then they've got maybe 3 or 4 new patients who are recently diagnosed, where do they have to spend resources? Is the resources keeping someone in the system that's been there for so long versus some, you know, new patients that are coming in, and if they get there early enough, might not get to the long stay. I don't know. I'm being a bit cynical there. That's probably a little bit naughty.
No.
I suppose there's only a certain amount of money, and, you know, who's to say? I mean, it shouldn't come into it at all. And there's no evidence that I'm aware of that says that. It's just, those are just my mum's thoughts.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying there's any evidence either, but I wouldn't say that you're probably far from the truth, which, you know, at the end of the day is awful, and won't be the decision of anybody that's working on in the hospitals supporting people. I mean, I can imagine, you know, if it's hard enough, the NG tube feeding, to make the decision of palliative care for somebody, I can imagine would be, you know, just an absolutely horrific decision. So I don't envy anybody that's having to make those decisions, and don't blame them. I think it's like you said, it's the resources that they're being provided with, the training that they're being provided with. But yeah, equally, that's terrifying in the sense if they don't even know how to support someone with an eating disorder, how the hell are they, do they know when to make the decision of palliative care for someone?
And I think that's the thing, isn't it? No one should be in the position to make that decision. It shouldn't be a decision that's even considered. Palliative care, I know, is very current, controversial, and under lots of discussions and decisions by lots of people. But anyway, my thoughts.
Yeah. I just wanted to end the podcast, and I hope that you don't mind me kind of saying this, but you've been through a hell of a lot. And you are a very strong person. You know, you're sat here and talking about it and what have you, and I can imagine that, you know, it's been difficult. So I guess just for people listening, how do you keep going? Because, you know, I can imagine it's hard to keep on keeping on.
So many people say that to me all the time. I don't know how you keep doing. I don't know how you do it. I think as a mum, you don't have an option. I mean, you know, I absolutely love, adore, as every mum does, their daughter. And I would do absolutely anything to swap places with her, to help her. I think I keep going because I'm lucky. I think lucky, if that's a word. I'm very able to put things into boxes. So when I'm at work, I've got my work head on, and that keeps me very, very busy. And it's completely different away from eating disorders. When I'm at home, yeah, I mean, the more I have time to think about it, I'm not always very strong, I can assure you. There's many a time I'm flooding in tears driving home from eating disorder units and just, you know, at the end of it. But you have to keep going, don't you? You can't not. I talk about it. I do. I'm probably not the consultant's best friend because I do challenge. I do ask questions, and I'm sure they think, oh God, it's that mother again. You know, I'm walking with Hope on her march this weekend and bannering things out. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is upset anybody in any team that Ellie's ever, you know, they've been supporting Ellie, because that's not the point of it. But I think being active and meeting other people in the same situation, in a bizarre way, it helps. So I would not like to be not working. I would not like to have other things that I can, you know, at least I can mix and match and not constantly. I think that would be the worst thing for a mother, to sort of give up a job and just be at home and worry, because I don't have time to worry. I just deliberately keep myself busy. As do most people, I suspect.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I'm just so grateful for people like yourself sharing your experience, because, you know, I think when people do experience a loved one being diagnosed with an eating disorder, because of the media and because of the way it's portrayed, they think, holy shit, this is a death sentence. I need to stop living right now. I need to stop seeing my friends. I need to stop working. You know, everything needs to be on pause so we can focus on getting them back to full health. And, you know, it's very difficult to then think, actually, that's not how we need to be. Like, I always, you know, the first time that I was diagnosed with my eating disorder, I was at home, but the second time I was at university, and the third time I was living away from home. So each experience has been quite different for my parents. And only the third time did my mum go to some like parent carer support groups, which have absolutely changed the experience for her, because she now takes time for herself, you know. And I guess that is easier when you're not living with somebody as well. But I always say to my partner as well, you know, you've got to take time out for yourself, because if you are trying to help me and your battery is on 0%, well, one, you're going to be pissed off at everything I do because you've just not got the energy to manage me. But equally, you know, you're not going to want that to be the only thing in your life. And equally with that, you know, I would say to my mum, when people ask how I am, tell them whatever you want to say, but don't let that be the whole conversation that night, talking about how me being poorly or me when I was poorly is impacting you. I need you to still have your life. I need you to still do the things that you want to do, which is so difficult when, you know, you can see someone is struggling so much. But I think that's like the biggest takeaway I've had is to keep those parts of your life, you know, you with your sons and things like that, you know, you don't want to suddenly be like, everything is focused on our daughter, because you've still got a family there and everything. But that's really difficult. So I think the community and having other people to talk to about how you're going through things is really, really helpful.
I think that's really important. And I think a lot of it will depend. I mean, I'd hate anyone listening to this to think that our story is normal. It's not normal. We have been very unlucky, or my daughter's been very unlucky to be so entrenched for so long. There are, I think, or I should say 90% of the people I've met on this journey, their daughters, their sons are, I'm not saying in complete recovery, but certainly holding down jobs and have moved forward. We just haven't got there yet. But I think it also depends very much on the actual person who has the eating disorder. So my daughter would never let us sit down and have a meal plan with her. She was absolutely insistent on cooking her own food. This is when she was very young and first diagnosed. So she wasn't receptive to us getting involved particularly with anything. I have got friends who literally did give up their jobs and they sat down and had three meal times a day, and we were very, very strict. We did try for 2 years, but our walls were covered in Fortisip, and the dog got fatter as she licked the walls, and we had, you know, door frames that we had to have replastered. You know, it just after 2 years, we just couldn't do it anymore. But again, that's why it's such an individual illness, because, you know, I think the mother or the father or the carer has to adapt to their lifestyle to be able to embrace, incorporate the eating disorder, but as I say, not let it rule their lives. And that took us a long time to get to saying that. Mm-hmm. But we don't now. You know, my husband and I go off and have long weekends away because we know that she's safe where she is. The challenge is when you know, she's next discharged and how we keep her safe. But that, you know, the moments we've got, we do try and live as well. It sounds a bit selfish, mm-hmm. doesn't it? But we have to.
Not in the slightest. I think I genuinely think it's the most important thing that you keep on living, because at the end of the day, you know, like I said, if you're not keeping your cup full, you can't then support your loved one. So I do think it is really important, but it's hard, you know, particularly I imagine when somebody's in a hospital, because you can't be there with them all the time.
You can't be with them all the time. Somebody else is looking after your child. That was my hardest thing when I sort of left her. I remember leaving her in somebody else's care, and you just think that's not what a mum does. So that's hard. But now I know that she's safe, and she is, I believe, in the best place, you know, that can support her or can certainly keep her safe. So you just have to. Everyone's different. I just call it stages. We're in this stage, we're in that stage, you know, and we'll go from one stage to the next and keep plodding along till we get to a better stage. And that's the way we do it, really.
Well, that better stage is 100% possible. And I so, so hope that you get there. Because, you know, I always hate this because it's the best people are affected the worst, and it's horrible because the best people should not be impacted. Well, nobody should be, but, you know.
No, you shouldn't. But anyway, it's good for people like you that are doing podcasts. And as I've said, I just don't want everyone to think, whoever listens to this, that our story is a common story, because it's not. It's just one of many stories out there and many experiences.
It's a difficult thing to balance, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you don't want people to think this is everybody's experience, because it's not. But on the other hand, you need to share your story in order for people to understand that this sort of thing is going on. So it's, exactly. You know, whilst not every situation is like this, it's also not wrong to say that a lot of situations have been like this. So it is hard, but that's the difficulty with eating disorders as well, I think, is that it's such a spectrum, and we can't sort of just say, you know, somebody has an eating disorder, therefore this happens, or they need this treatment or what have you. It's really got to be individualized to the person. Yeah. And even then, you know, that is so difficult, and that takes a lot of time to unpick. I've been struggling for, I think, about 14 years now, and only in the last year have I realized that I keep being diagnosed with anorexia and I just don't understand. Like, I'm like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't feel like I have anorexia when they explain it to me. And over the past few months, we've really started unpicking that. And now so many things are coming to light. And I'm like, okay, this makes sense. And now I feel like I can actually embrace recovery because I'm like, ah, I understand what the purpose is now. Yeah. But, you know, that can take so long.
I think it takes so long, and it takes the right people that can connect with the patient to be able to be given the charge to explain that in the first place. Because, you know, let's face it, in real life, people get along with people and people don't get along with people. People will listen to people and some people they won't listen to. And I think that is heightened in eating disorder services. And there are just some people that connect with patient or a patient and vice versa. So if you've got that special person that can connect with that, whatever that person's traits are, then, you know, that's beginning of the battle to be going there. Mm-hmm. It's not like I say, it's not like a cancer consultant who doesn't matter whether they connect with them or not.
No.
You know, it's a very specialised area, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Nikki, thank you so much. Honestly, I'm so grateful that you've had the chat with me. I'm actually really disappointed as well, because I went to the march last year and I definitely recognize your face, but we didn't chat. And this year I'm unfortunately going to be on a sunbed with my mum in La Palma. So it's so hard.
Well, at least you're guaranteed sunshine.
Oh god, I know, I can't wait. But yeah, it was that when Hope said the date, I was like, can we change it? And she did try, but never unfortunately I won't be there. Yeah, I'll be there in spirit. So Absolutely.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.